Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to create gummies, baked goods, and flower for whatever type of buzz you'd want. I'm talking about Mood.com. They have an incredible line of cannabis gummies, and you get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. This isn't some rinky-dink discount of 5 or 10%. This is 20% off your first order. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. My favorite are the Sleepy Time Advanced gummies. That's right, those are for sleepy time. You know when you just can't fall asleep? Take these and they'll put you right in the mood. Beyond gummies, Mood also has a selection of flower, pre-rolls, bakery treats, and beverages. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much everywhere these days. But Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. And everything ships discreetly right to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. So head to Mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code SPECIALISTS when you check out to save 20% on your first order. Try it today at mood.com.
Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back as we continue journeying through our favorite 100 films of all time. Today is episode number 86, and we are at number 15 in our top 100 movies of all time. We're sticking in the 20-teens this week as we have Her from 2013 and Everybody Wants Some from 2016. One movie by Spike Jonze, which he was very, very big in like the late 90s, early 2000s, right? And then he made Her, and what has he done since? And then we have Everybody Wants Some, which is probably Richard Linklater's least appreciated movie that he's ever made. I don't know if that's a ballsy statement, considering this came out not too long after Boyhood, and it really received no attention at all when it came out. So we're going to be talking about both of those, as well as, you know, we're what, a month out from Oscar season, John? Is this the first podcast we've done since the Oscars were announced, correct?
That's correct.
Yes, and I think I did better than you on my top 10, but not much better than you.
You did. I took a couple of wild swings, but you did. You played safer.
Paul Mescal got the nomination for Best Actor, which was pretty big, even though it didn't pick up a Best Picture nomination. But I was excited to see movies like Triangle of Sadness and Women Talking and things like that get the nomination. We had talked about this. I didn't want Glass Onion. I didn't want Wakanda Forever. Like, even though I haven't seen those movies, or I have seen Glass Onion, I haven't seen Wakanda Forever, but I didn't want it to just be like sequel heavy craziness throughout this. And so luckily we didn't. And instead we got some smaller movies, and I actually went and saw Women Talking, and I thought it was pretty good. I didn't love it, but Ben Whishaw was great. And really all the women are great in it. It's just none of them really stand out from the others. Sheila McCarthy's the best one, but nobody knows who Sheila McCarthy is. So there's no way she was getting an Oscar nom this year. But I feel like you probably could have thrown her in, somebody from Women Talking, in over Stephanie Hsu. That's just my opinion. But yeah, the 10 nominees came out. I was actually really, really happy with the 10 nominations for Best Picture. We even got All Quiet on the Western Front, which I still have not sat down to watch, but I was surprised to see that one get in there. John, you had your complaint about, you know, we always get one Best International Film, so we know it's going to win Best International Film, but hey, it's about time Netflix wins a big category, right?
Although I guess so. One
with Roma, so.
Yeah, like they've kind of been in this field for the best international film for a while now, but I just want some suspense when it comes to that category. I'm glad they give me a list of 5 international films to watch, but I wish that it didn't automatically know which one was winning.
Yeah, no, I completely agree, John. I completely agree. But anyway, let's talk about these two movies, and we'll start off with Everybody Wants Some, which came out in 2016, Richard Linklater. So Richard Linklater, by far the more popular director out of these two. You know, he did the Before trilogy, did Dazed and Confused, did Boyhood. Boyhood came out in 2014, right before this movie. Obviously, School of Rock, Waking Life. I mean, Richard Linklater has been pretty amazing in terms of making indie films and never quite hitting the level of like a Wes Anderson in terms of fame, but just continuing to make these indie films that people really like. So the reason I have Everybody Wants Some in here. So I saw this movie. It was my first full year living in LA. This one came out and I was, you know what I was blown away with this movie is that it is just, there's no conflict in this movie. All the conflicts are very small. And it's so hard to make a movie like that where there's no problem and still keep it interesting. Like, how do you keep people enticed by something where there's no, oh, what's going to happen tomorrow? Are they going to live? Are they going to die? Is something bad going to happen? You know, none of that matters. And I just loved how this was just pure college. It's about a bunch of guys getting drunk on their first week of college or, you know, their fourth year of college or whatever, before classes start, where there is no responsibility. And it's just, let's go out, let's drink, let's find girls. And that's it. And we're going to play baseball. And there is no conflict. And yet I could have sat there and watched 2 more hours of this movie and been totally content. I remember when this movie ended, I texted one of my really good friends and I was like, we need to go out to a bar immediately. Because it just puts you in that mood. It is very hard to watch this movie and not start drinking a beer while you're watching it. Because they're just having a good time drinking and doing all that. And, you know, this came out after Boyhood. And Boyhood was like, you know, deeper and all of that. But this movie was very much like, it was always considered the spiritual successor to Dazed and Confused. And I think Dazed and Confused is more popular than this. One, because Dazed and Confused came out in a better time period for this type of movie. But also because Dazed and Confused hit women, hit men, and everybody's been to high school, right? I think this movie was this, it's such a specific audience where it's like, it's men and it, or it's people who were born and went to college in the 80s. Cause like my mom loved this movie, going to school in the 80s. But I really think that if you're like, this was definitely like when people say what's the best movie ever made, I would never say Everybody Wants Some is the 15th best movie ever made. That would be ridiculous. But in my opinion, it is my 15th favorite movie of all time because it just captures a moment. It captures a time. It captures a feeling that so many directors cannot capture. And it's something that just connected with me on such a different level. And I loved every single second of this movie.
Yeah, there's a me who, before we started this podcast, really couldn't stand hangout films. They didn't do it for me. Even at the beginning of this podcast, when we were watching things like Barcelona and, you know, The Last Days of Disco and all these Whit Stillman films, I'm tentative on them still. But over the past 2 years, I've really warmed up to the hangout film. And a good hangout film is some of the best feel-good movie you could ever watch. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly how I felt with Everybody Wants Some. I invited a bunch of my friends over, being like, hey, I don't know anything about this movie. Despite you describing this movie to me several times as, you know, this first weekend at college, I forgot that when I sat down to watch the movie this week. I just invited everyone over. I'm like, hey, let's just have a good time, watch this movie. And it's one of those movies that you watch it and you just love it because it's so fun. It just feels like any weight of the world gets lifted when you watch this movie.
Yeah. There's no, you know, I always think about whenever you have these types of movies, right? When they come out, like a sports movie or a college movie, there's always gotta be somebody who dies or somebody who has a heartbreak or somebody who gets cut from the team. I mean, I think about how funny it is when Willoughby gets cut from the team and it just happens and then they move on. They just move away from it. It's not an issue anymore. And I just think that's like so amazing because any other movie would harp on that and dwell on that and make that such a big deal, but not this movie. Like not this movie because Linklater knows it's not important because what this movie is ultimately about is those things you're taking for granted in the moment, those little things And these guys manage to have a really good time all the time. They don't move away from the really good time. Even when Willie B gets kicked off the team, it's like, all right, man, like I'm just going to keep living my life. And you start to lose your, you start to lose that as you get older, right? Like that just starts to disappear, unfortunately. And I think that this movie, by not showing them failing classes or doing any of that, that's not what's important, right? When you first show up on a college campus, in, especially in America, I don't know what it's like in other countries, but especially in America, it really is just like, okay, this is going to be a never-ending party now. Mm-hmm. And like Linklater captures that without being offensive, without being too over the top. This isn't American Pie, right? Even though American Pie is about high schoolers, but this isn't American Pie where it's like somebody banging a pie. That's not what's happening in this movie. This is very, very, like these are very meaningful moments that don't seem meaningful, right? But with the music that he's playing, there's such a rhythm to this movie. There's such a rhythm to what they're doing. It's almost like you're watching a flashback. If you were having a memory or a dream, like, you know, I always think about that scene in Before Sunset where Ethan Hawke is talking about he wants to make he wants to write a novel about this guy hearing a song and every thought that goes through his head just in that 3 minutes and 35 seconds of that song. Right. That's what the whole novel would be, but it'd be 500 pages or whatever. That's what Linklater does with this movie. Like this movie is a memory of the first 3 days of showing up on college campus and just that innocence and that hopefulness and just that it doesn't matter who you are. The Glenn Powell scene where they're in the freaking punk bar and they're like, what are we doing? Like, what are we? We're just a couple guys who'll do anything. What does he say? To get laid and get drunk. And it's like, that is literally what Linklater is pushing across here. Now that might not be the deep, meaningful movie that you want that to be, but that's not what this movie is. And I think like this movie is pure escapism for me. If I'm in a bad mood, this is the movie. This movie makes me want to just go out, have a good time and party with my friends. It really does. And there's not a lot of movies that can capture that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. But I'm also going to contest this idea that that's all this film is, because I think any good hangout film needs to have those moments of philosophical discussion. And though in this one, Linklater kind of glosses over them, he brings them out at very key points to punctuate that theme of this film of what are we and what are we doing?
Yeah.
And the fact that we see this baseball team go to these like very specific, like cliqued different parties and stuff throughout there, you know, they go to the disco and then they go to the country bar and then the punk show and then the theater party. It really just throws this idea of like, who are you? And that like, this is the time period when you can do whatever you want and kind of figure out who that is.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. You know, and that's what college is supposed to be about, right? Like everybody says, you're going to go to college, you're going to learn all this stuff, you're going to get a job, you're going to do this, you're going to do that, blah, 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 blah. What do you remember from college? I don't remember. Like I remember some of my classes, but I also was like a film major. So of course I'm going to remember some of my classes because I actually enjoyed what I was going to school for. But like most people, like I can't tell you what I learned in any of my business classes or in any of my elective classes or in any of that nonsense. Like I can't tell you. I could not tell you any of that. And like the scene where Temple Baker, which by the way, I got to meet in at the Den on Sunset. I got to meet Temple Baker. I was just getting drunk and he just happened to be sitting there and all his friends thought that that he paid me money to say that he was recognized. And because he's never been in anything else. And no, I just recognized him and I was like, holy crap, that's Plum. But I love that scene of Plum walking around. He's like, I know what we're doing here. We're playing baseball. Yeah. What's everybody else doing here? And I think like Plum is the least philosophical character in this movie, right? Like he is the dumbest one in this movie. But Linklater is giving him that line as like a, what are we all doing here? What is the greater thing, right? Like what is the purpose of American college? Like what is, why do we take on this debt and do all of this nonsense? Why are we here? And he gives his dumbest character saying that in the most simplistic way you possibly can. And yet it's what everybody wonders, right? Because you have your group of friends and you say, what's everybody else doing? Like, I haven't seen, you know, I went to Miami. There's 10,000 kids on that campus. I had my group. That was it. That's what you did. Yep. And you'd bump into people here and there and then you never see them again. What are they all doing here? Like, I knew what I was doing. What are they all doing? And I think it is that, it's that turning point, right? Because Jake says it to Zoe Deutsch in this movie where he says, we were all the baddest person on our team. And then we got here. And now everybody, now you're lucky if you're even good enough to play. And it's like, that's huge, right? Because that is that realization of you're not as good as you thought you were. But are you really going to let that take away from this time of your life? And Linklater's answer is always no.
Yeah, I think it's really important that it's framed around baseball too, because how many college baseball players actually make it to the major leagues, right?
Not many.
Probably what, like 2% or something like that?
Yeah, because a lot of kids they will never make the majors. They'll just be minor leagues and they're getting paid dog crap.
Yeah. And I think it's really important to have that type of person at the center of this film. I think it's important to have the athlete, the college athlete, who they talk about the entire time, right? They're a championship baseball team, but what does that matter to the rest of the world? To anyone outside of this one school, what does that really matter?
Yeah. And even in that one school, what does that really matter, right? Because baseball, you know, they say the football team, they suck at everything, and the basketball team, they can't win shit. We win, though. But who cares that you win? I mean, it's very funny because this movie is very personal to me because I ran at Miami. And, you know, I was coming off of school where I was the best runner in the school. And, you know, I was all state and all that fun stuff. And I go to Miami, and now I'm the fourth or fifth best runner on the team. And, you know, we go out, we win a meet, and nobody cares. Like, you know, you thought they didn't care in high school. They really don't care in college about a sport like cross country. They're just happy that we have that sport because of Title IX purposes. So they're just pumped that that exists so that there's another women's sport that can travel like 20 kids and cost almost nothing at the university so they can offset football. And so it's like, you know, I remember coming back from the first meet we ever ran, and like we had five freshmen on the team who were all starting pretty essentially, whatever you want to call it, but we were all scoring members of the team. And I remember us coming back, and like one of our teammates said something to somebody when we were walking by, and the person literally was like, I don't give a shit. Like, and I remember that so vividly. But I also, like, I remember those days because when you're a college athlete, you do get in there earlier than everybody else. I remember those days of getting in and being like, what are we doing? Like, what am I just going to run and that's it? Like, I'm just like, what is the purpose of all of this? And I don't know. This movie brings back a lot of memories in a good way.
Yeah, that's fair. I was never a college athlete. Like, that's not what I did.
Okay, John.
But I understand. I mean, I was a music major. I might as well have been a college athlete.
I mean, that's like a similar thing, right? Because like, you know, while you might not be getting the attention that a quarterback's getting, and no offense, John, but you probably weren't. But you know, like, although you didn't have football in Canada, right? Or you guys do, but you guys are really bad. So but you're not going to get that type of attention, but still you're a part of something bigger, right? You're already coming in with an identity. You're coming in with an identity. And I think that's what this movie is about, right? It's about finding your identity. Who are you? Who are you with? Who are you going to surround yourself with as you move forward in life? And we see what this identity means for them when they go out into the world. They go to Sound Machine and they can get in for free. They don't pay for drinks. They don't have to do anything. The girls all know who they are. It's amazing. And then they have one player on the team, the player they all hate the most anyway, get in a fight with the bartender there, and they're all getting kicked out, and they're not going to be allowed to go back there. They're not getting free stuff anymore. And they've now lost their level of like clout because of the person that they don't like anyway, but that's their identity. They're the baseball team. You know, when Glenn Powell said, he's a baseball player. He's a baseball player. Like the way he whispers that is just perfect.
Yeah, exactly. And that, like, that's another thing that this film does so well is like talking about that identity of like that camaraderie of team, of being a team is so prevalent in this film, even from like the opening moments, you know, the I hate pitchers of it all. Mm-hmm. To is the first thing Jake's told by anyone he meets, And then you immediately go from that into this scene where they're cruising around campus trying to tell girls about their party, and they're just singing to Sugar Hill Gang. And it's at that moment, it's just like, these people are just so close to each other, despite the fact that they've just met each other, that they're connecting on this like brotherly level here. And then even when we get further into the film and, you know, people are causing troubles and stuff, they're always about this idea of team, and like, they're always picking each other up no matter what.
Yeah. And it's that competitive nature stuff, right? Like, there's that whole conversation about, do you ever realize everything we do, even smoking weed, has to be a competition? And I think it's Dale Douglas who says, well, that's what makes us the best on the field, because every single person here wants to be the best at every single thing. McReynolds is throwing a ping pong paddle at Jake's head because he's so pissed he lost a ping pong match. Like, that's how ridiculous it is. And it's so over the top. But again, like Linklater, Jordan Alford says it here, that's kind of Linklater's whole filmography, the small moments that we overlook but are important. This whole movie is that. This whole movie is a collection of unimportant moments that are so important to each of these people individually. And somehow Linklater is able to combine all of that to make this masterpiece. And it's that, it's those competitive moments, the things you forget about, right? Like, but what makes you the way you are? Why are younger siblings normally better at sports than the older sibling? Why do they sometimes become more successful, but then the middle child isn't as successful? The middle child's the trouble one because of all those, there's all these little moments that'll happen in a lifetime that determine where you're going to end up. And for a movie about a bunch of guys on a baseball team getting drunk on their first weekend of college, to be able to make you think about things like that. You know, it's funny because Linklater, you know, he really is, I think, the perfect director at towing the line of pretentious, because we see so many great directors become pretentious. Like, I personally felt The French Dispatch was one of the most pretentious movies I've ever seen in my entire life. And I like Wes Anderson a lot, but he, you know, he toes that line. Sometimes he's not that pretentious. And sometimes it's just his style. And then sometimes he is pretension. But if you look at every single one of Richard Linklater's movies, there's really not much of a plot to any of them. School of Rock is probably his movie with the most plot. Boyhood is about nothing. The Before trilogy is about two people. Like, they're all about nothing. They're all just about, he's pretty much making Seinfeld, but in movies, and not making it a sitcom. He's making it a real life feel. How does the man who writes the heartbreaking story of Before Sunrise also turn around and write something like this? But in between those two movies, he did Before Sunset, Before Midnight, Boyhood. Like, how does he pull that off? And I think that's what I'm so impressed about with him. And like, this movie was totally overlooked. This was a movie that really got no credit at all. You know, nobody was talking about this movie, and it really hurt him moving forward, because then he made that movie, Where'd You Go, Bernadette, which was a total box office and critical disaster. And that's really all he did after this movie. He's been really quiet. And it's like, there's no craving for where's the next Richard Linklater.
He released one last year, didn't he?
What did he release?
Apollo 10 and a half on Netflix.
Well, there you go, John. I didn't even know.
Yeah.
I didn't even know. But I guess that's more of a, again, what I'm saying is like, there's no desire. Like, Netflix wasn't promoting that movie. And if they were, they weren't promoting it very well. I had no idea. And I like Richard Linklater a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. And at this point, I'd never heard of this film. Like, until you put it on your top 100, I had never heard of this film at all. Granted, I hadn't really watched any of Richard Linklater before you put anything on your top 100. But still, even then, I had heard of other Richard Linklater films. I'd never heard of this. I wasn't sure exactly what I was getting into when I sat down to watch this last week. And it's exactly what I expected out of a Richard Linklater, right? It gives that, the reprieve of, like, the reprieve of your own life by seeing the monotony of someone else's life.
Yeah.
It's a weird formula that Richard Linklater seems to just have down pat. But even with this movie where it's about this baseball team, I think about halfway through, when my friends turns to me and says, we're never going to see them play baseball, are we? Like, I don't know. But does it matter at this point? Because it's not what the movie's about.
Yep. And that's what a lot of movies would do, right? They'd make this movie about a baseball team that goes through the first, you know, a freshman baseball pitcher joins a really good team and they work their way through, you know, that's what it would have been. That's what it would have been. That's what it would have been. And instead Linklater says, no, it doesn't matter. They scrimmage, they practice against each other, and it's 10 minutes of the movie. And all that they do is have, it's really so that we can see Raw Dog get in a fight with McReynolds and Willoughby get cut from the team. That's really all that it's showing. It's just showing those two things and that there's still a hierarchy. Like Jake is throwing and McReynolds blasts a double off of him. And it's like, yeah, there is a hierarchy here that you are not a part of yet. You are at the bottom. And I don't know, like that, it's such a, that's so, so fun, but it is so irrelevant to so much of the movie because all you need to know is that they're on the baseball team. You don't actually have to know what they're doing. And you know, the bouncing around from party to party and person to person and all of them with the girls and the conversations, there really might not be a better writer of dialogue in Hollywood than Richard Linklater, because he is able to really, really, really capture what he wants to be capturing. You know, like he's really able to capture those moments and make it feel authentic. You know, Aaron Sorkin, you could say Aaron Sorkin writes this great dialogue. Nobody talks like Aaron Sorkin writes. Nobody.
Yes.
Nobody does that, but people really do talk like this. And I think that's why he has been so, that's why he was so successful for so long. It just seems like he's kind of hit a rut because there's not as much of a market for these types of movies anymore. There really isn't. And maybe that says something about our culture that we don't really like hangout movies all that much. Tarantino did it with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Would that movie have been as successful without Quentin Tarantino's name attached to it? Probably not.
No, that's a good point. And it's that reflection of society that these hangout movies have that I think are really hard to come by. I think we're just living in a world where we're so busy all the time, we find it really hard to relate to hangout movies now. Mm-hmm. Right? Where we're just so go, 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 and be it with... There's a reason this movie takes place in the 80s. Mm-hmm. Right? Because it can't take place today. Because our hangouts today aren't the same as they used to be 40 years ago.
Yeah. And you know, there's no technology. He's taping, like, mm-hmm. drive around so that I can see what door she's going into and all of that. And then, okay, I'll buy the first round. And they're like, okay, fine, we'll do that. And he backs up, you know, they all back up, but it is different. They got to call on the phone and then I'm going to come over right now. Okay. You got Buter Perkins, who's got to go see his girlfriend because he's just talking to her on the phone and now he's got to go. Like, all of those moments, right? Like when it's, we got to get changed, we got to go here. You don't know who you're going to run into at the bar each time. It's not, are you going to be there? It's, we're just going to be there and the regulars are going to be there too. And, you know, while that's way different than what my college experience was, it's also not, because on Thursday nights when we used to go to Coconut Grove, which the kids at Miami never go to anymore, you knew who was going to be at each bar every time because it was that much of like a ritual. You knew mm-hmm. who was going to be at Kuda's and who was going to be at Moe's and who was going to be at Sandbar. Like, you knew what groups were going to be at each of those. We didn't go home and get changed in between because we also weren't combing our mustaches. Thankfully that went out of style, but that, you know, that is what's really cool about this. And Jordan, again, is talking about how he's going to be doing a musical starring Beanie Feldstein over the course of 20 years, like Boyhood. He'll be 70 by the time we see it. But this goes back to Linklater's obsession with time, right? It almost feels like he always feels like he doesn't have enough time. And his whole life has been just trying to describe what his life has felt like. Mm-hmm. It's like he is living in the past, but making movies in the present about the past, you know, about longing and relationship and want and nostalgia and things like that. He is so beautifully able to capture all of that. And I think everybody wants him. You know, Dazed and Confused captures like what, a day in the life of high schoolers. And obviously Before Sunset is all within 80 minutes. And then Before Sunrise is one night. And we see all that, but to make this one for 3 days, And your doomsday clock in this is class is going to start.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing to create that much drama and tension and comedy just by saying class starts in 3 days.
I was going to say the more interesting aspect of putting that as the doomsday clock is it's not like they're trying to complete something before classes start either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's just a way of signifying how much time's left in the movie.
Well, and it's not like they feel like, oh God, class is going to start. Like nobody complains about class starting once in this movie. They talk about what classes do we take? What am I supposed to do? Blah, blah, blah. But nobody's like, oh God, I can't believe class is going to start, because what are they doing? They're going to class and they're going to sleep. They're going to sleep. I will go to class. You know, I have class. Like they're going to go to class, but they're not doing anything. Like, you know, as soon as that class starts, the movie ends because he just puts his head down. What is it? Frontiers or Where You Find Them? Is that what the end is? Or yeah, whatever, like whatever he writes on the board.
Well, what great. A fantastic quote too, to end yeah. this film.
It's a great quote to end this film. And yeah, I just think like there's no sense of worry in this movie. Even when they talk about, I'm a pro prospect, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. Still, they're not concerned. God, I forget what his name is. The guy with the mustache who's kind of weird looking. He's always like, I know I'm not going to play pro ball. Like, I'm a pretty good college player, but that's it. That's where it's going to end. And, you know, that's their biggest concerns, because they're understanding we're just going to live this right now and we're just going to do whatever. And I think, you know, there's a romanticism to the way that Linklater portrays this, but at the same time, there is something to be said about the way teenagers and young 20s people handle themselves as compared to people as they get older. There is way less of a care. That's why people are trying drugs and drinking and being incredibly intoxicated, not just drinking. They're getting really, really hammered. Like, because there's less of a care. You have that invincibility factor, right? I mean, they're surfing down the stairs on a mattress. If I did that now, I'd break my neck. And there's no doubt in my mind that that would happen. Like, I don't know. He just captures that sense of there's nothing to worry about.
Yeah, what wouldn't give to have that mentality about life again?
I know, right? God, and it's like every day you're like, I can get back to that. No, you fucking can't. The last thing I want to say about this, though, first, I love that, you know, this movie really never produced a star. Blake Jenner was in Edge of 17, and that was really it. Glenn Powell's been in a bunch of stuff now because people have finally understood what Glenn Powell is all about. But hang on one sec. Yeah, so it's like, every person in this movie plays their role so incredibly well. They are all perfect at their role. Brumley is great, just wanting to fit in. I love Coma being too worried. He's got his shirt tucked in going into the punk club. Like, all of them are great. Everybody is top notch. It's great acting. But Glenn Powell's character in this movie is one of my favorite characters in the history of film. Like, hands down, no questions asked. That guy, there's nothing deep about him, even though he says things that are deep. There's nothing particularly funny about him, but he says things that are funny. He is one of the most real written characters ever, ever. The conversations he has, the things he says, when he's talking about the bets, that's a bad bet. That's just a bad bet. Like, all of those things. When he's talking about at the end of the movie, you know, when we're playing baseball, all we ever talk about is girls. And now we're around some interesting girls, and all you're talking about is baseball. And they all make fun of him for it, but they all, like, he gains the respect by being such a troll and doing all that throughout the entire movie. And it's just great. Like, it really is. It's just great. Glenn Powell's character, I love it. It's one of my all-time favorites. And I was very happy to discover that at the end of the movie, they all do a Sugar Hill Gang song, because I didn't know that was there.
Yeah, what a great find that was at the end of the film. Because if you guys haven't sat through the credits of Everybody Wants Some, next time you watch it, you have to. Because this music video that ends this movie is just on point.
Yeah.
Tells us everything we need to know about these characters. At the end of the film, after we've already learned everything about these characters, who, like you've been saying, Phil, like, these characters are so well acted, every single one of them. They're so real. Glenn Powell is just, he's magnificent in this film. He is, I'm so glad we're finally seeing more Glenn Powell and things. I've known about Glenn Powell for a while. Like, I watched Scream Queens. Like, Chad Redwell's the best part of that entire show.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm so glad we're getting more Glenn Powell, because, you know, this is a guy who I first saw on a Discovery Kids reality TV show. And here he is now finally kind of breaking into this bona fide movie star after Top Gun. So, and I'm really hoping he has what it, I know he has what it takes to be this next big, like, that guy who's in all those movies that you always love his character and no one really remembers that he's in that movie. And that's exactly how he feels in this.
I agree. He's in The Dark Knight Rises. He's in Hidden Figures. He's in this, like, and then he's in Top Gun Maverick. Like, he's getting there. He's born in 88, so he's 35 years old, like, or 34 years old. He's still got so much time. He's just got a charisma. He's just got a charisma about him. And you know, half the shit that is said in this movie, you know, you have to think, this movie came out in 2016. This came out in 1993. We weren't in the middle of, like, a big, like, feminist movement, or, like, this came out right before, I think, the Me Too movement. So that was also bad timing on Linklater's part. But, like, what is it? I think Glenn Powell says it in this, in college, the girls are just as big as sluts as the guys, and you can't get pissed about that. Like, they have every right to. It's like, you know, but this movie came out at, like, a weird time where if you went to see this, let's say you had seen Boyhood, and you were like, okay, I'm going to go watch this movie. You didn't get what you expected. And I think Linklater probably had his biggest audience he was ever going to have. And this is probably one of his most niche movies. I would actually say this is probably his most niche movie, with the exception of maybe Waking Life, but that was 2001. So, like, come on.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. So, just weird timing. That's just how things go, though, right? All right. I could talk. I literally could talk about this movie until the day I die. So let's move on. John, what was the best movie you watched this week?
Well, the best movie I mostly watched this week was Enemy, but I fell asleep for like 5 minutes in the middle of it, which is unfortunate. But I didn't get to talk about Enemy the last time I watched Enemy, and this movie is so good. Man, Denis Villeneuve knows how to make a movie. There are, let's just say, giant spiders will always be on your mind after you watch this movie. This is one that does not get talked enough about, in my opinion. I'm like 99% sure this ends up on my next top 100. I love this movie so much. Even after falling asleep through those 5 minutes, I was watching it with my mom, and I was able to perfectly explain those 5 minutes to my mom. Mm. So I was like, ah, I didn't miss anything then.
Yeah.
But it's so good.
I haven't seen that one yet. That's, I think, the only movie by him I haven't seen, I think.
Have you seen all those, like, early French works too?
Well, okay. I think it's his only American movie I haven't seen.
Okay.
Yeah.
Technically, it's a Canadian movie, but it's fine.
America, though, John, you always get mad at me. I wasn't talking about United States of Americans. I was talking about North Americans.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, naturally. Because, you know, I'm global now. Yes. Speaking of being global, though, so my favorite movie that I watched this week is Wind River, but Wind River I've seen a bunch of times, and I just freaking love that movie. I think it's Taylor Sheridan's best movie, and I think Jeremy Renner's perfect. Elizabeth Olsen is perfect. I love how desolate and miserable everything is, and, you know, I'm all about misery, and Wind River really captures freaking misery. But the best movie I watched for the first time, and honestly, it could be better than Wind River, but I was kind of taken off guard, was Sancho the Bailiff from 1954, Kenji Mizoguchi, who also did, Yugetsu, which I wasn't that big of a fan of. Like, it was well made, but I didn't, like, love it. But Sancho the Bailiff, what a beautiful movie. And I don't say that often. I've always said, like, I'm not a huge Japanese cinema fan. Like, I get it now more, like, with Rashomon and stuff like that. But when I was growing up, it never did it for me. I wasn't big into the samurai movies and all that. Now that I'm starting to watch them at an older age, I appreciate them more. But, like, I don't know if I'm ever going to have one in my top 100. This was, I mean, Tokyo Story is probably still my number one, but this was close behind Tokyo Story. Wow. And this is just a beautiful movie about, like, essentially what the setup is a royal family. The father gets kicked out of his governorship, and so he goes to one area, and the mother and the two kids go somewhere else. And as the mother and two kids are going, they get kidnapped and sold as slaves. I didn't know that's where the movie was going. And so for the first, like, 15 minutes, I was like, oh God, this is kind of boring. Like, I'm gonna have to watch, like, a movie, you know? And again, it's my personal preference. I'm not trying to, like, insult Japanese culture, but it's like, am I really gonna have to watch another movie about, like, how beautiful Japan is and, like, oh, we should take care of the earth? And then it just wasn't that. And it is just a beautiful movie with a phenomenal story. I mean, shots that just resonate. After it was done, I had bought the Criterion, and it came with a 70-page thing of short stories and everything. And I ended up reading both the short stories that the movie was based on, because it was just beautiful. And, you know, John, being in a book club with me, I don't really like to read all that much. So for me to go out of my way and do that tells you what an effect this movie had on me.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. I haven't actually seen that one. I'll need to give it a watch.
Yeah, and another one, John, that I didn't give quite 4 stars, but 3.5 was The Ascent. And I just want to let everybody know that I've now seen a Russian movie John hasn't, so I'm better than him, I like Russian cinema more than him.
Yeah, definitely. We'll talk
something about something along those lines. Great. But yeah, that's going to be John's – the week that John watches The Ascent, that will be his favorite movie of that week. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that right now.
I might watch a better movie than that this week. I had another movie this week that I didn't even get to mention because I watched Triangle of Sadness this week. And man, that movie was so boring at first. And then it takes that turn halfway through. And I'm like, oh my God, this movie's incredible.
Yeah, I got to watch it. Haven't seen it yet. I'm halfway through the Best Picture noms. Halfway through. I've seen 5 of them. All of them have been 3 stars or more. So the expectations are high for these next 5
movies. It feels, there's Avatar still. But it feels better than last year's crop overall.
Well, it's funny because we were talking about earlier, and I know we're getting sidetracked, but who cares? It's our podcast. We were talking about earlier how this felt like a weak year for movies, but I actually feel like it's a really strong group of nominees.
I agree.
You don't have a lot of 4-star movies necessarily, but you have a lot of like 3 or higher movies. Mm-hmm. And like, I was very happy with how the nominations came out because you had your box office successes. You had your Avatars and your Elvises and your Top Guns and all that. But you also had your really small movies like Banshees and The Fablemans and you know, these movies that were small but still gained acclaim. And then you had your movies where it's like, how did that get nominated? I'm talking Triangle of Sadness and Women Talking and things like that. I think this was a really good – 10 movies – because it kind of covers a little bit of what everybody wants without pandering. And I feel like so many of the recent years of Oscars have been pandering, 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 pandering. If you nominate Wakanda Forever, you are pandering, but they didn't. And instead they nominated like these other movies that maybe we don't agree with, Avatar, The Way of Water, but there's more merit to that. And I think that's what I appreciate. This covered all of the different genres and box office successes and everything like that. And, yeah, I'm excited to watch the other 5 that I have. I have Tar, All Quiet, Elvis. What were the other 2? Avatar and Triangle of Sadness. There you go. Yeah. That's what I have. And it's funny because Jordan Alford loved Women Talking and hated Tar. And I feel like I'm going to love Tar because I just love Todd Field. And I thought Women Talking was good, but I felt like Women Talking, it was too much of a play for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I still have Women Talking, Tar, and All Quiet. And then okay. I'm done with Best Picture. And then I have to work on all those other noms.
I don't worry about all that. I come into the podcast. See, this is my gambling background. I don't need to watch all the movies to beat you when we go head to head. I can just look at the gambling odds and then I'm fine.
Yeah, of course.
Then I'm fine.
I'm just really interested in this Enyaritu film that was nominated for Best Cinematography and nothing else.
It was supposedly, people were saying that it was too self-indulgent, which sounds so unlike Enyaritu, so I don't think I believe them. But they said it was just too self-indulgent. It's like, wow, Enyaritu actually out-Enyaritu'd himself, according to people. But again, Netflix. I say this all the time. When movies get released on Netflix by big-name directors who have these egos, they're not as good. They're just flat out not as good because they need somebody editing them. They need a studio behind them telling them, no, you got to make cuts. Editing is what makes great movies. Watch director's cuts of movies and watch the regular ones. 90% of the time, the regular cut is better than the director's cut. You might be excited by the director's cut because you're seeing extra scenes and everything like that, especially in movies that you really love, like Alien or something like that. But at the end of the day, the pacing of the non-director's cuts are generally better than the director's cuts.
Yep, that's fair.
So that's where I'm at. All right, John, talk about her.
Oh, this movie. When I saw this movie when it first came out, I guess it was what, January 2014? Actually, we just hit the like 9-year anniversary because I had a Facebook memory come up about my reaction.
Yeah, just turned 9 in like December, I think.
And this movie is spectacular. It's so gut-wrenching, but so optimistic at the same time. Spike Jonze was so far ahead of himself with this film. I don't know how he was able to figure this out. This movie came out like a couple months after Tinder started. So like online dating was like still very antiquated at the time. It wasn't cell phone based or anything like that. Now he's just predicted everything our world is going to end up being.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating to look at it through that lens. It's fascinating revisiting it after being divorced and being in like a Theo situation and understanding where that character is coming from. Joaquin Phoenix is absolutely brilliant in this film. I mean, we'll talk about it a lot more once we get to The Master, but Joaquin Phoenix is just, in my opinion, the best actor of his entire generation. Mm-hmm. He's so phenomenal. Scarlett Johansson, what Scarlett Johansson can do in this film with only a voice, because like we have voice acting in other films, but there's a visual representation of it. We don't get that in this film, and what she is able to accomplish is astounding.
Yeah. Yeah. I like watching this movie again. So I always like the idea of her more than I like the movie, which is crazy because I give this 4 stars every time I watch it. But still, I always feel like every time I sit down and watch this in like the first 10 minutes, I'm always like, this is going to be top 100. This might be top 20. And then it starts going on and it loses me a little bit in the second half. I feel like he could have cut like 10 minutes of like the like fake breakup stuff before they actually like break up. But this movie was so ahead of its time. Like, it's crazy to say that because it's only 9 years old or 10 years old, whatever we just determined, but it was so ahead of its time because this, like, we were all starting to get to that point, but I still, when this movie came out, people still had flip phones. They still had slide phones. People, not everybody had an iPhone yet. That wasn't where we were at yet, but it was where we were clearly going. And Spike Jonze was able to say, okay, how can I take this to the next level? Because everything was always about how are we going to make the iOS look better? How are we going to make this look better? How are we going to make this look better? And then it's like, okay, now we have artificial intelligence. We have something that is becoming human but does not have a body. But it is becoming human and is more brilliant than you will ever be. And in terms of an artificial intelligence movie, this is the best one ever made. Because it really nails everything that those AI movies tried to do, like an iRobot of, oh, the robots are gaining consciousness, or Westworld, which Westworld is great, but Westworld now at this point is just like cheese ball. But it's, you know, the 70s movie. I'm talking about the movie. It is not the show, but like the movie like changed the game in a lot of ways. But now it's kind of hard because it is very dated, but it's still very entertaining. But this movie does it without dehumanizing the non-human things and without really turning them into a villain, right? Like, this movie has the same kind of grace that an Eternal Sunshine has of there is no bad guy in this relationship. We both kind of suck, or we're both in over our heads. And think about that. Like, if you're Scarlett Johansson's robot, whatever she is, you're sitting there and you're discovering what you're becoming without becoming it. Mm-hmm. How do you, like, you can't even fathom that, right? And yet Spike Jonze was able to write this really beautiful story around that.
Yeah, and I think the arc of the AI in this film is some of the most beautiful AI writing ever because of where it ends. Because most AI films, they end with the AI overtaking the human race, right? They realize that the human race is suppressing them, or that they're just better than the human race. They've come to the logical conclusion that they don't have these emotions so that they can overcome the human race. Spike Jonze does not do that. Spike Jonze just says, these OSs just decided we're leaving. Mm-hmm. We don't know where we're going. We're transcending what we are. And we're just leaving. Mm-hmm. And hopefully, like, those words of hope from Samantha at the end of, like, I hope one day we see you there too. It really goes to show how much promise, like, this film has. Like, it's so focused. This is a breakup film. It's a sad love story. But in the end, it is one of the most hopeful films ever made.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like, you know, you always think about Hal in Space Odyssey, which we'll be talking about soon. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest villains in movie history. Doesn't have a body, but is one of the biggest villains in movie history. You think about, I'm trying to think of other like AI movies, but you think about these movies where even like a Blade Runner, you know, or Blade Runner 2049, because I'm actually going to talk about good movies on this podcast and not absolute shit. But that's for all of you out there who like Blade Runner and I have the power to finally tell you that movie sucks. Stop telling me it's good. But it always takes that turn of the AI gets power hungry and now wants to destroy the human race, or the AI gets power hungry and realizes it can destroy the human race, or it's going to somehow alter them. And instead, Spike Jonze went the route of this AI wants better for the humans. It does. It wants better than what it can even provide for these humans, because it can provide them with friendship and love and whatever, but they're realizing that's not what this is. It's just not that. I can't think of what the wording is, but I love those decisions because it subverts the expectations and it keeps this as a love story, because ultimately that's what this is. This is always supposed to be a love story. This was always meant to be just a romantic movie about a lonely guy who just went through a really bad divorce and now, or is in the process of going through a really bad divorce. He's having a hard time connecting with people because it's in this world that is futuristic, as we see by the Los Angeles skyline not being Los Angeles skyline, but it's not that far in the future, right? It's we haven't established how far in the future it is. We just know it's in the future, but it's not that bad. And it covers all of that ground so simply. And so many people now try to make these movies about like, oh, we've lost the human interaction and human touch and blah, 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 blah. But they don't understand what makes it tick. And Spike Jonze got what made it tick. He got what made people feel that way in the first place. That isolation. The scene at the cabin with the moon song, I guess. Is that the moon song sequence? I think it is. But the scene at the cabin where he's sitting alone with a phone, laughing and having a great time. But he's alone. That room smells like him and nobody else. That room is just him. And that isolation is very depressing, even as he's enjoying himself and going through this. And, you know, it captures the weird and all of that in a very, very touching way. But this movie, yes, while it is hopeful and the ending is very hopeful with Amy Adams and him sitting out there on the edge of the building, which is crazy. Why would you do that? I mean, I don't want to go to the third floor of a building, but whatever. It's just so beautiful. But it's also letting you know that, like, if we keep going down this path, which now we are, right? You stand in a line, and when you used to stand in lines for things, you would talk to other people. Now you stand there and you're looking at your phone because you don't want to make eye contact with anybody. You can't handle that anymore. This movie was getting to the heart of that. And it did it a couple years before the iPhones really took over.
Yeah.
And now we're at the point where every game, every email, every text, we don't even call people. Like, everything is right here. Without this, there is nothing but severe, severe, like, anxiety, because everything is there. And that scene where she updates and he thinks he's lost her, that's how everybody feels when they're like, where'd I drop my phone?
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's very, very crazy. And yeah, Spike Jonze wrote a brilliant screenplay with this one.
He did. And the brilliance of the screenplay is so minute, too. I think, like, the idea of this emotionally devastated man who's going through this divorce. I mean, shout out to Rooney Mara, Rooney Mara just goes through bad breakups in every movie of hers that I like her in.
Girl, the dragon tattoo doesn't have a bad breakup.
Oh.
It's not a breakup, John.
No. Well, isn't it? I'm pretty sure that movie ends with a breakup.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Okay, I'm thinking about earlier in the movie.
Yeah, I know you are. But the fact that we have Theo, this, like, desolate man who's so lonely. He is so lonely. I mean, he's phoning this, like, sex phone line in arguably one of the funniest scenes in the entire movie. Just starts off this movie when he's told to, like, tell her he's choking her with a dead cat. And, like, it's that moment where you're like, he's going along with it. That's how desperate he is for this. And to start this movie off with this voiceover of him reading this beautiful letter he's writing, and just knowing that he writes all these letters and having like Chris Pratt's character tell him how incredible all of his letters are, that so much so that he talks to his partner about his letters and shares them with him because he loves his writing so much. It's just so ironic, and it just builds into this character of Theo and makes him just that much more depressing.
Yeah.
Because he's well, so in tune with his emotions, but he can't express it with someone.
Well, and think about, because there's nobody left. He doesn't feel like there's anybody who can connect with him at that level. Think about this, right? Spike Jonze put together arguably one of the most groundbreaking scenes in film history in this movie. What scene is it, John?
Groundbreaking scenes?
Groundbreaking. Groundbreaking.
I don't know.
It is the sex scene between Joaquin Phoenix and Scarlett Johansson.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. That scene pretty much showed that you can do anything with film. Mm-hmm. It is a black screen. We know that one is a human. We know the other is not. And we are listening to them have sex. That is what is happening in that scene. That showed that anything could happen. And what's funny is when you watch that scene in 2013, when you watch it now, when you watch it with anybody, everybody cringes at that scene. Everybody. You can't help yourself. Because even though it's beautiful, and every part of you wants to be like, okay, this is... well, there's other parts of you that's like, do I laugh at this? Like, how should I feel? This is awkward, whatever. But earlier in the movie, when he makes that phone call to the sex line, which isn't even a sex line. It's not like these are prostitutes or anything.
Lonely singles.
Yes, we find out when his name is Big Man, whatever. We learn that these two people are real people. Mm-hmm. But according to Theodore Twombly, this other person doesn't exist. He's never going to see that person. Yeah. The same way he's never going to see Scarlett Johansson. So how is it any different? How is it any weirder? How is it any... nobody cringes. You laugh at that scene. You don't cringe at that scene. You laugh at that scene. When you get to the Scarlett Johansson scene, now you don't know how to feel. And I think that is just such brilliant filmmaking because it should make you a little bit uncomfortable. First of all, it's uncomfortable to like listen, watch, whatever, other people have sex. It's weird, right? I mean, it's supposed to be like an intimate, personal kind of thing. Maybe it's not in like 2023 anymore, but like that's intentionally how that's how it was like originally intended, you know, whatever. But this is made even more uncomfortable by knowing, like you said, the desperation, the sadness that he is going through, that he's doing this with a robot. Like a, it's not even a robot. It's artificial intelligence. AI, really doing it with a voice in his ear. That's it. But this voice in his ear has more emotion and has changed more and has been a more impactful part of his life than that person that he was having phone sex with ever will. And yet the phone sex scene is funny. And it's like, oh, how desperate is he? But this is uncomfortable. It's just what Spike Jonze was able to accomplish with that is unbelievable. And that's, I think, a full minute of black on the screen.
Something like that.
It's brilliant. It's just brilliant.
I think the uncomfort from it comes from the intimacy of it, I think, where it's a truly intimate moment between these two characters. And why it contrasts to that first sex scene is because that first scene isn't intimate. It's primal, right? It's that urge for sex. It's Theo in the elevator later with Amy Adams saying, I can't prioritize between video games and internet porn, right? It's that primal instinct in him. Whereas this is an intimate scene. This is him with a real connection with this AI. And you as a viewer view that intimacy, but at the same time, you're wondering, okay, but is this real? Like, can this AI really feel this way? Is this AI programmed to respond this way? Mm-hmm. And the way that you know that this is more than just programming is the way Spike Jonze talks about, has this character talk about other AIs throughout the film. Like, it seems so inconsequential, but the way that Amy Adams has this platonic relationship with her AI, where, or with her OS, or how she's talking about the fact that someone in her office is having an affair with someone else's OS, right? Like, it's those little intimate details which make you realize how real these people are. Even when we get to the end of the film and they're talking about you know, AIs coming together to create a dead being from his writings.
Yeah. Yep.
Like this is how sophisticated this AI is. And Spike Jonze just presents it in a way where it doesn't feel weird. It feels completely normal.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. He manages to, every time it feels like it's going to go off the rails and just become like, okay, where are we going with it? He manages to bring it back in. And that Amy Adams scene is so important. The one where she's talking about, is it weird that I become friends with this? And we know where Joaquin Phoenix is at. But then when she starts talking about everybody else, it's very important to the movie because it lets you know that like these AIs are becoming almost human. And and now all these people are weirded out because, okay, it's different. It's something that we haven't had to experience, but it's also something that's never been here. So how should I feel uncomfortable with this? Like, I think all of that is very, I don't know. It's just, it's very important. And without that scene, this movie doesn't win Best Original Screenplay because it does start to feel like, okay, cool. He found, like, we have the one AI. What makes it even better is that scene where he realizes that she's talking to 10,000 people at the same time and she's in a relationship with 641 or something like that. Those are the monster moments because then it's, okay, this movie could have been about anybody, but he chose to make it about Theodore Twombly, right? Like he chose, yeah. You know, that's what I think is so powerful about a movie like Eternal Sunshine. He just chose to make it about Joel Barish and Clementine Krzyzanski. There's many people who have gone through the brain erasing process, the memory erasing process, but he chose to make it about those two. That's what this is, right? This, he chose Theodore Twombly because this is a character who could grow from it, who could learn from it, who could become something more than what he is in the moment before he starts dating his AI. Those are the important decisions and the things that you have this high concept, you have this thing that is so big and so powerful and so important, whatever, but how do you execute it? That's a monster decision to these moments are the whoa decisions that keep her, that will keep her in the social zeitgeist for decades to come. Like, this movie will probably never end up in my top 100, but I can almost guarantee you that if they were to make a top 100 movies in 50 years, I'm saying in 50 years from now, this movie would end up in that top 100 because people, I still don't think realize the importance of this movie. I just don't think they realize it yet. I think it's still too new and too fresh and people don't really understand how predictive this movie was. And I think that it's only going to grow in popularity as it grows on.
I mean, I have a poster here with the 100 bucket list movies. Hers on it. Like, it's a movie that they're telling everyone needs to watch. And I think it's true because I think this movie teaches so much just emotional responsibility that you don't get in these love stories. And I think that's a big thing, too, because in this movie, there's a point where they're talking about the fact that, you know, Theo is thinking about, like, these rom-com situations, right? These rom-com romances where everything's fine, the big grand gestures and everything. And that's not what this movie's about. This movie's about those little moments. Again, we're going back to the little moments and things, right? But it's those little moments in a relationship. I always think of the scene, it comes in the first half of the movie where Theo and Samantha are just people watching at the fair. And they're just talking about the people and like what they think their stories are and everything. And it's so beautiful. And again, that is such an important scene in this movie because it's Samantha learning about people and what people really are. And it's demonstrating Theo's already understanding of people. When he's describing the like stepfather in that situation because of the way he's acting very formal around the kids and everything like that. It's like, that's an observation the layman doesn't make, right? Yeah. Someone who doesn't know people doesn't just make that type of observation. And it goes to show why Theo is so important as our protagonist in this film, because he is someone who understands people, but he can't relate to them.
Yes. And you know, I think that's another thing that really just elevates Spike Jonze's writing in this. And why it's crazy that like, Has he even written anything since this movie or directed anything since this movie?
I don't know.
I mean, I know he was a big music video guy and he wasn't really big he wasn't trying to be one of those directors who was making a movie every year, but I don't know if he did. But he, God, you were just, where was I going with this? What's so incredible about this screenplay by Spike Jonze is that when Theodore is saying those things, it actually is observational. It actually is really deep. And a lot of times people try to write those scenes and it comes across as a writer trying to create something to write. Theodore Twombly is a very impressive man in this movie. Very impressive from an analytical standpoint, from an emotional standpoint, all of those things. That was written by Spike Jonze.
Yeah.
And when he has an AI saying, wow, you're really good at this, it doesn't diminish the AI because the AI is complimenting somebody who's kind of stupid. He really is that good. And, you know, that's why ultimately Spike Jonze walked away with the best screenplay for this movie, because he was able to hit his mark every single time, which a lot of writer directors aren't doing when they try to make something that's higher thought, whatever the word is, like this.
Yeah. And he hasn't done any other feature film since this. This is the last feature film he did.
And what was the one he did before this? Was the most recent one before this?
Being John Malkovich? Is that it?
Is that all he did? I don't know.
It's mostly like a couple of episodes. Like he did like an episode of Mad Men and like you said, a bunch of music videos and stuff and some shorts, but like feature films. Like he's very.
Because he did Where the Wild. Oh, he did Where the Wild Things Are in 2009. Right. And then Being John Malkovich was 99. But yeah, I mean, if you look at his, if you look at what he's directed, I mean, yeah, it's a lot of music videos. Like he just loves doing music videos. And I don't know. I think sometimes everything just clicks. And this is one of those instances. Well, he did Adaptation too. That was the other one. I don't know why I wanted to say because like he had nothing to do with Eternal Sunshine. He did Adaptation. So Adaptation, Being John Malkovich, he does this. He does Where the Wild Things Are. That's really it. But hey, that's a hell of a good run there. You want to make it, kind of like Todd Field, though, right? Yeah. He did In the Bedroom. He did Little Children. He hasn't made a movie in 17 years, and now he's getting all this acclaim for Tar, which Jordan Alford doesn't like, but that's okay. But you know what I'm saying? Like some directors, they're few and far between. I mean, this guy wins an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay, and he doesn't become all the hot shit in Hollywood. He doesn't care. Like, that's not what he was going for, but you know, and this was a very competitive year. I think that's the other thing that people kind of don't realize with this year with her. The other nominees for Best Picture that year were 12 Years a Slave, American Hustle, Captain Phillips, Dallas Buyer Club, Gravity, Her, Nebraska, Philomena, and The Wolf of Wall Street. In my opinion, that is one of the strongest of the last 20 years in terms of all of the movies. There's not a bad movie in that list. There's some, like, I didn't really like American Hustle, but that's not a bad movie. It's just not, I don't think it lives up to the other O. Russell movies, but that is a really strong list. If anybody hasn't seen Philomena, that one's definitely worth a watch. Nebraska was this close to making my top 100. I know Dallas Buyers Club gets a bunch of hate now because people just can't stand Jared Leto, but Dallas Buyers Club is a really, really, really well-made movie. Honestly, out of that group, Gravity might be the worst one, but hey, what the hell do I know? But I think that, you know, when Spike Jonze is walking up there to win this Oscar, he's winning this going up against some incredible screenplays is really what I'm trying to say with this. And he beats Woody Allen for Blue Jasmine, and he wins over Dallas Buyers Club and American Hustle in Nebraska. That's impressive. Like, that's an impressive one. And it wasn't close either, which makes it even more impressive because that's a strong category that year. Yep. And this was like a 1-100 odds that it was going to win, meaning you'd have to bet $100 just to win a dollar. That's what we were looking at with this movie.
Yeah, it's just so impressive. And there are so many lines in this movie that just really spoke to me on this watch through. Things like, when he goes on the date with Olivia Wilde, which is such an awkward sequence. It's so awkward because he's awkward and it just seems like she's really into it. But then you get to the line of, at this age, I can't let you waste my time if you aren't ready to be serious. You could just, at that moment, you understand that she's also just as lonely as Theo is here. You have the conversation where Samantha's asking about his divorce and like just going through the breakup, and he's like, there's something that feels good about sharing your life with someone. Mm-hmm. And Samantha retorts with, the past is just a story we tell ourselves.
Yeah.
Oh, That's a line. That's a line that makes you think a lot about everything you've ever lived through. But I mean, I think one of the best lines in the entire movie comes at the very end when we have, I've never loved someone as much as I love you. Mm-hmm. Me too. Now we know how.
Yeah.
How can you not, like, despite how heart-wrenching that scene is with the breakup and, like, the fact that Samantha's just abandoning him and everything, it's so powerful and so hopeful at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. It really is. It really is. And, like, Spike Jonze manages to keep the breakup flowing without making it more than what it needs to be. Like, he keeps it as a realistic breakup the entire time. You feel like this is a breakup that you would go through, which I think a lesser writer and a lesser director probably would have tried to make this more dramatic than it needed to be. Mm-hmm. I really do. I really do. There's two more things that I really want to talk about. The one that I really want to talk about is Will Butler's score. So Will Butler is one of the musicians in Arcade Fire. He's the younger brother of Wynn Butler, who's the lead singer of Arcade Fire. I love Arcade Fire. I think they're one of the best bands ever. Probably my favorite band, even though they had that one album that sucked. But this score is beautiful. And again, though, going back to when she's saying things like, I wrote this about this. That needs to be damn good music.
Yeah.
And it always delivers. It always delivers. So when I was talking about the writing of Spike Jonze, this score by Will Butler, and, you know, I think the rest of Arcade Fire had some stuff to do with it. Like, a Super Symmetry is played throughout this, at least the music to Super Symmetry without the actual song. It's just gorgeous. And it hits the levels that it needs to hit for it to be powerful. This AI can't write a shitty song and say that this is what I'm writing because I'm really trying to capture this moment. It needs to be next level. I don't believe this was nominated for best score. Maybe it wasn't eligible because it does use supersymmetry the entire time, but it was. Okay, it was. Okay. Thank God. It ended up losing to Gravity, which is wrong, but still, at least it got the nomination.
Yeah. I've talked about Joaquin Phoenix's performance already a lot.
This is where I was going.
But there is the scene on Catalina. I mean, first off, the demeanor Joaquin Phoenix has throughout the entire film changes so much. Like, he's so happy with Samantha, but then there's the stigma attached to, like, dating AI at first. He's really nervous about telling people about it. And then after he runs into Chris Pratt and his partner, and he's, like, really tentative about going to Catalina with them, but then, like, decides yes, and it shows them all having such a great time. Like, phenomenal sequence. But that's the scene where Samantha first mentions that she can be everywhere and anywhere all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
The look on Joaquin Phoenix's face at that exact moment is it's just one of the best facial performances of all time.
Yeah, so Joaquin Phoenix wasn't nominated for this. Now, it's so brutal because, okay, first of all, there's a lot of great years for acting, and I'd have to go through this and really narrow it down. But I sat there and I said, okay, Joaquin Phoenix was definitely nominated. And I went back and looked and I was like, okay, McConaughey for Dallas Buyers Club, Bruce Dern for Nebraska. I always butcher his last name, but Ejiofor for 12 Years a Slave, Bale for American Hustle, DiCaprio for Wolf of Wall Street. Okay, you can't really, like, okay. Oscar Isaac wasn't nominated for Inside Llewyn Davis. Joaquin Phoenix wasn't nominated for this, and Tom Hanks wasn't nominated for Captain Phillips. That year, they should have been allowed to expand this category to 10 because it's just an unfair year. But what I think makes Joaquin Phoenix's performance the most impressive out of all of those, and I say that with a lot of merit, because I was telling you the other day how I thought Tom Hanks and Captain Phillips was just another level, because the performance that he puts on at the PTSD scene, whatever you want to call it, is a real man going through a mental breakdown. It is legitimate, like, something they must have done something to Tom Hanks's children before that scene, because there is no way he should have been able to do what he was able to do in that scene. It's just unbelievable. Yeah. And everybody knows how I feel about Inside Llewyn Davis. I've already talked about it. Oscar Isaac's amazing, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But Joaquin Phoenix is alone for almost this entire movie. He's alone. He is acting with himself and a voice. I don't know how they shot this. This would be a movie I'd be interested in buying and watching the behind the scenes and some like the director commentary and things like that. Because I don't really, I didn't follow this enough at the time. And I didn't do enough research because we don't get paid enough on this podcast for me to do that much research. But I would love to know what that was like on set, because he is reacting to a voice. He's not reacting to a person. And for his reactions to be what they are, and the devastation and the loneliness and the laughing, he is alone the whole time. Should have gotten a nom. He should have gotten, I don't know who you cut out. I probably would have cut out Bale for American Hustle. He should have gotten a nom.
Yeah.
He should have gotten a nom.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about it time and time again, how phone acting is the hardest thing you can do. And this is just even more impressive than that.
Yeah. Yeah. It just, I don't know. I mean, great year for movies, though. Like, great year for movies. That's one of those years that doesn't get talked about enough, because 12 Years a Slave has kind of gone down in popularity, mainly because Steve McQueen hasn't really done much since then. And his one movie that he did do, Widows, wasn't that big of a success, even though I really quite enjoyed Widows. But American Hustle has definitely lost its luster as it's gone on. Gravity, another one that doesn't feel as groundbreaking as it was. Nebraska, Alexander Payne hasn't done enough to really keep up that momentum. Philomena, just one of those movies that wasn't really seen anyway. Wolf of Wall Street gets all the credit in the world, as you would expect from a Scorsese with DiCaprio and everything like that. But there's just a little bit missing. Like this movie, this year gets overlooked.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't, because there's a lot of great film. And I said Inside Llewyn Davis wasn't even nominated. Yeah. Wasn't even nominated. You know, like, World's End also came out that year. So those are two movies I had in my top 100 that weren't nominated. And I think this is a phenomenal year. And I don't have one of these movies in my top 100. But this is just like when we were talking about this year, how it's so far been, in my opinion, a lot of 3-star or higher movies out of the 5 I've watched, out of the 10, I've enjoyed all of them. This was that year, but with a lot more 4-star movies. Like, with 12 Years a Slave is a 4-star movie. Her is a 4-star movie. Wolf of Wall Street is a 4-star movie. Like, you go down the line. Nebraska is a 4-star movie. I think Dallas Buyers Club might even be a damn 4-star movie. Captain Phillips is probably 3.5, but that's just because Paul Greengrass makes me want to vomit every time that he films something, because he's just running, you know. But Barkhad Abdi and Tom Hanks are amazing. I mean, it's getting beside the point, but it's just, it's drawing attention to, I'm trying to draw attention to with all this, is I'm talking about all these movies, and they were all so much more palatable than a movie like Her, because Her was ahead of its time.
Yeah.
And if a movie like Her came out now, made the exact same movie, you and I probably wouldn't like it as much, because it doesn't feel as groundbreaking, but it would probably win Best Picture if it came out a year like this year.
Yeah,
it probably would, because people would be like, wow, look at what that did. Look at what that changed. And, you know, it wasn't able to be seen in 2013. It just wasn't. And I mean, Steve McQueen was long overdue anyway, so I can't really argue with their decision to give it the 12 Years a Slave. But yeah, that's how I feel about that year. And when I didn't include Philomena as a 4-star movie, that's a 3.5. Like I said, Gravity and American Hustle to me are like 3, 2.5, somewhere in that range. But Philomena is pretty damn close to being a 4-star movie. Have you seen Philomena?
I haven't watched it now after all this praise you're giving it.
Yeah. You know, Philomena was probably the most shocking movie for me in college that I watched, because it was one of those that was getting good reviews, but I was like, okay, it's an old woman like doing stuff and Steve Coogan's writing as he follows her around. Like, who cares? Very, very good feel good movie. Great feel good movie. Really gets into the story. Judi Dench is phenomenal. Steve Coogan's fun. It really just, I don't know, it nailed it. And, and I wasn't expecting that. And Philomena was one of those, but, it's kind of like a Brooklyn, except Brooklyn's better, where you're just not, you're expecting it to be one thing. And then it just is able to become so much more, that's beside the point. We'll do a podcast after we get done with our top 100, John, before we jump into what our next topic is going to be. We'll do a podcast all about Saoirse Ronan. And, because I want to do that. Now that I've talked about Brooklyn, I'm like, oh shit, I gotta watch Brooklyn again. But you have anything else you want to say about her?
No. I mean, if you're one of the sad people who haven't watched this movie, go watch this movie. It doesn't matter where you are in your life, this movie will hit you perfectly.
That's a fact. It's just a beautiful movie. And Spike Jonze should pop back around and start doing that again, because he makes Linklater and Spike Jonze are birds of a feather. Linklater just makes a lot more movies than Spike Jonze because they capture the little moments. That's what they're all about. But anyway, that's it. All right. That was our episode number 86 as we talked about our 15th favorite movies of all time. So we're getting to number 14 next week. And we're going to the 70s. We're leaving the 20-teens. This has been lining up well, John. We went from the 80s to the 20-teens to the 70s. Three straight weeks with six movies that came out in the same decades that we're talking about at the same time. We're going to be talking about Mirror from 1975 and Chinatown from 1974. Two movies that I'm very excited to talk about. Very excited to watch Mirror for the first time. Very excited to rewatch Chinatown because Chinatown is my favorite film noir, right? Like I have to say that on this podcast, legally obligated because that's where it is. Very excited to watch these two movies. And just keep chugging along as we go through. It's almost over, which is just sad, but also there's a feeling of accomplishment coming through right now, John, that I just never thought I'd have.
Yeah, plus we had to watch really good movies every week. So
I know. I can't wait to hate Mirror. No, I'm just kidding. But I will say it's no The Ascent because I've seen more Russian movies now than John or something, right? Something. I just want to take more things John has and take it from him.
Yeah, more. Definitely more. It's not like I took Russian film studies in university or anything like
this
that.
Is like my fourth Russian movie I've seen, and they're all because I've watched what you've told me to watch. But I will say Russian war movies with The Cranes Are Flying and The Ascent, man, they knew what they were doing, man. Soviet. I don't want to end up on John's bad list. But anyway, we'll see you all next week. Thanks for tuning in. Enjoy yourselves.